science setting of TF Edinburgh under the supervision of Christina Boswell about older migrants living in hostel accommodations in France. And he also studied the question of return in his PhD. So, and he got the EMISCO Prize in 2013 for the best PhD thesis. After that, Alistair worked as a research fellow at the University of Edinburgh with his former supervisor, Christina Boswell, on the relationship between research and policy making. Then he conducted another research at the University of St Andrews, Scotland, on the Middle Eastern Christian migrants in the UK. And today he's going to present his ongoing research on legislating for transnational aging, a challenge for the Dutch and French welfare states. This is a research that he started during his PhD and that he is continuing since his stay in Paris, during his stays in Paris since last March. And so this is a comparative research and also a collaborative work with Anita Booker from the Red Cross University. So thank you, I give the floor.
Thank you very much, Marion Laurence, for that introduction, and thank you for coming along today. On behalf of Anita, my co-author, I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to speak today. To begin with, I'd like to situate our intervention in the context of the seminar series on migration and social protection. I've had a look at the seminar program and see that some of the seminars are going to be on social protection for urban migrants for their kin left behind as well. Others are looking at the social protection which migrants access themselves in the countries of residence. Whereas this presentation looks more at the social protection rights gained by migrants in a particular country here, France and the Netherlands, and the question of the exportability of those social protection rights to a third country, often a country of origin, if at the end of the working life, people are interested in returning. This question of the exportability of social protection is more salient in later life for two reasons. First of all, the fact that generally older people are in greater need of social protection provisions such as healthcare, old age income, and so on. And secondly, the fact that later life, and more specifically the fact of becoming a pensioner, is a critical juncture for relocation, including international migration. The fact that the statutory constraint of participation in the labour market will further apply, thanks to the pension, means that they can choose what they do about the rest of their days. So ageing transnationally becomes an option, and it's an option which is more and more taken up as stats on the numbers of pensions paid abroad show. So two graphs here. On your left, Dutch public old age pensions. The blue curve shows pensions paid in the Netherlands. So there's an increase between 1999 and 2009, 10-15%. But for pensions paid abroad, the purple line, much more significant increase, 80% increase since 1999. The French graph is a bit more basic, just shows the kind of raw numbers of pensions exported, and you see in 1990, a figure of 400,000 pensions paid abroad, and that has risen to over a million as of 2010. So, transnational aging is facilitated by the payment of pensions abroad. Often that is facilitated through bilateral social security arrangements between labour source countries and labour recruitment countries. But there are other social protection rights and provisions which are much less exportable, and this can be a constraint to transnational aging. These constraints are primarily due to the nationalistic and territorial, let's say, logics of the welfare state, and I'll come to them shortly. We find two notions quite helpful for describing the obstacles to transnational aging through social protection. First is a notion of legal gates. This is a concept developed by Anushka Gehring in a special issue of Population Space and Place, which I am co-editing. Anushka draws on the new mobilities paradigm literature and the idea of gates in terms of border control, how that's theorized in this new mobilities paradigm. But she applies this to also social security legislation and regulations and how that can also channel mobility, structure mobility. She sees that legal gates may facilitate, impede, or indeed enforce mobility, and in particular those who are less well off, either in financial terms or health terms, are more likely to face either impeded mobility through these welfare rules or enforced mobility in order to get care and so on. Another concept we find useful is timetabling, or more particularly I find useful because I developed it in my PhD. And this is to describe the effects of the temporal conditions attached to social policy provisions, social policy measures. I should give a little bit of context on my PhD, which is, as Marion Morris mentioned, set in migrant worker hostels in France. The migrant worker hostel policy dates from the late 1950s, early 60s. I was in these hostels, and there are about 700 hostels in France now, were a means for the French state, first of all, to keep tabs on the Algerian citizens, or the French Algerian citizens at that time, because it was a period of the War of Independence in France, so the Algerians were seen as a suspect population. However, the hostels were then expanded to other labor market groups, other nationalities. At a kind of peak of labor migration to France in the 70s, had around a quarter of a million beds available in social conditions. It's a very significant policy measure by the French state. Ironically, even though these hostels meant to be a short-term housing measure for a short-term population, they continue to exist, and the people who live in them have continued to live there. They have aged within the buildings, and so the average age in these hostels is around 60 years old. There's currently around 100,000 residents across France in this accommodation. 60% from North Africa, a third from West Africa, four French colonies in part of the world. For two-thirds of residents, their family is left behind. The wives and children have remained in countries of origin, and so they've continued to send remittances throughout their working lives. So they're kind of transnational, you could say archetypal transnational. They have these bases in France. Ironically, at retirement, the men tend not to return definitively, even though they have their family there and their pensions worth more money in Morocco or Mali than they are in Paris or Marseille. So the purchasing power of their pensions. And I observed that one of the reasons behind this lack of definitive return and preference for back and forth migration is that these, you could say, these temporal conditions attached to social protection, timetable presence between France and other places. So I find this notion of timetabling useful. One example of these timetabling and conditions are cash benefits, which is old age income support. This is legally non-exportable, one that's resided in France for at least 6 months. Similarly, provisions apply to Dutch old age income support. There you have to be in the Netherlands at least 4 months. Another interesting particularity of the French case is the annual tax declaration, which must be completed. And the tax form is sent every year in April or May to each taxpayer's home address in France. That has to be signed and sent back in May. So this is a peak period, you can see, legislation here in France, the aid for social family and social reinsertion, older migrants in a country of origin, and in the Netherlands, a much more simply named remigration benefit. Both schemes involve the export of social protection for older people, and both schemes question what I would say are received wisdoms. First of all, the territorial and national state logics of the welfare state. For both schemes, the benefits are only payable to non-nationals, and they're only payable if you leave the territory. So this is an interesting counterintuitive aspect of social protection. And we find that these kind of reversals or inversions of these logics of the welfare state are occurring at a time in all other domains of social protection in Europe. The welfare state is in a process of retrenchment rather than expansion. So this is what persuaded Anita myself to look into this further. In the concluding slide, looking to the future, we speculate on whether on what the prospects are for these forms of exportability of social protection to facilitate transnational aging. Will these schemes remain exceptional to France and the Netherlands, or will other countries follow suit? Before that, however, I will give a brief overview of the theoretical framework, which is these logics of the welfare state. So, as the Dutch sociologist Abraham de Swan notes, the welfare state is inherently nationalistic and protectionist. In his words, and I'll read it out for the benefit of people listening in on the podcast, if anybody does indeed listen in. Welfare states are national states. Care is provided only for the nation's residents. If one wishes to contemplate welfare states in an international perspective, one must begin with the understanding that states close the territory against other states, and that welfare states shield the domain of entitlement against foreigners. Seen in this perspective, a welfare state is not only a national system, but it is also anti-international. A socially secure society is also a closed society. The welfare state is commonly defined by three principles. The first is solidarity. The welfare state is a political community whose members have implicitly agreed to set a number of social objectives which the market is unable to achieve. In order to achieve these objectives, the market principle of distribution according to individual economic performance must be partly replaced by forms of redistribution require generalized reciprocity or indeed diffuse solidarity among members. Second principle is nationality. The welfare state is developed within the legal political framework of the nation state. National laws may make entitlement to benefits conditional not only on residence or employment but also on nationality of the state in question, or they may impose additional eligibility requirements on non-nationals. And the third principle is that of territoriality. Welfare states are reserved, or welfare state benefits are reserved for persons residing or working within a territory at the exclusion of those who live or work outside the state borders. Also, territoriality implies that welfare state benefits must be consumed within the state borders, and this is also what Jost Hoffman writes about. And again, I quote, from the point of view of the state, welfare policies are meant to impose a territorial criterion on the politics of inclusion. This includes the attempts of the nation state to restrict the welfare state benefits to its citizens or to demand the consumption of benefits of the state territory. To return to the French and Dutch legislation, which is the empirical focus of the presentation, and our guiding question of what motivated policy makers to seek to facilitate transnational aging in this way. As noted, we're looking at these two pieces of legislation, the aid for family and social reinsertion in France and the immigration benefit in the Netherlands. As I mentioned, these two measures contravene these principles of nationality and territoriality. Only non-nationals can access this social protection, and they can only access it by leaving French or Dutch territory. We look at how policymakers initially framed this question, their initial motivations for legislating in this area, and then subsequently how the legislation developed. I should just clarify that our analysis is based on available documents, both the legislation itself, background notes to the legislation, debates in Parliament, parliamentary committees and so on, and also some interviews which we have conducted and plan to conduct further interviews in the coming months. So it is a work in progress, I should make that clear. So the following slide, this slide here, just gives you a kind of brief overview of the scope of the legislation. The French aid is a more recent scheme from 2007. The Dutch re-migration benefit was created initially in the mid-80s, but has recently been revised in 2013-14. We'll look at the development of both of these. There are some key similarities and differences, and these two columns show that fairly clearly. There are some interesting similarities and differences. For example, in the French case, it's a yearly payment which is transferred to the individual, whereas in the Dutch case, it's a monthly payment. In both cases, initially only third country nationals were eligible. In the French case, more specifically, the third country nationals living in this coastal accommodation. Slight differences in terms of the age criteria, 65 years in France, 55 years in the Netherlands. Also differences in terms of the residence requirements, 15 years prior residence in France versus 5 years in the Netherlands. But generally, applying to people who have low incomes, an interesting difference between the French aid and the Dutch aid is that in the Netherlands it's only available for those who are intending to return permanently to the country of origin, although there is a facilitated visa service if you do wish to return for a holiday to see relatives and so on. Whereas in the French case it's a bit more flexible. You could certainly return permanently, but one may also just a more extended visit in the country of origin. The notion of extended visit was never specified in the legislation, but certainly over 6 months or per year, I would say. Finally, some information about kind of a number of people who could be eligible for this. So we'll turn to the Dutch re-migration benefit, first of all. In terms of the initial motivations of policymakers, I would characterise this as paternalistic pragmatism, and I'll explain what I mean by this. As mentioned, the re-migration benefit was initially developed in the mid-1980s, and this was a time of mass unemployment of low-skilled migrant workers in the Netherlands. Due to their lack of socio-economic integration, the prospect of them being able to rejoin the labour market later in life. So the Dutch government initiated this re-migration benefit for those who wanted to return to their place of origin but stayed on because they had an interest in receiving the unemployment. So I just describe this as paternalistic pragmatism because it's aimed at those who have, in some ways, failed in their migration or integration projects. And the state takes care of these failed migrants. And pragmatic because the government realised that the situation of these men living in France, living in the Netherlands, are only to receive unemployment benefit, re-benefits. You know, so the government would pay monthly sums so that they return. However, the cost of the question of budgetary savings for the Dutch welfare state was not raised at this point in time, which is a difference from the French case. What is also another factor in the context to this remigration benefit is the minorities policy, which was in place in the Netherlands at the time. This was the Dutch integration policy aimed at promoting migrant socio-economic integration without forcing them to give up their ethnic, cultural heritage and identity. And in some ways the remigration scheme completes this policy, because those who have not succeeded in socio-economic integration are able to return to their ethnic, cultural roots. Interesting way of coming full circle with the minorities concept. The pilot scheme in 1985 became permanent in 1987 and was given a statutory basis in 2000. How the legislation is subsequently developed. During its first 18 years until 2003, this inversion of territoriality and nationality did not arouse any concern or debate. Indeed, the scheme was broadened several times. The extension to other target groups, including EU citizens, whereas before in the 1985 version of the legislation was only third country nationals. Also, the age limit was lowered to 45, so really not talking about aging anymore. However, in 2003, there was a change of government and also, I think, it was a change of climate within the Netherlands, becoming more anti-immigration and more anti-multiculturalist. The minorities policy was seen to have failed, and the incoming government pledged to repeal the Immigration Act. However, a cost-benefit analysis commissioned by various migrant rights organisations showed that, and I should say, one of the rationales for the government to repeal this benefit was that they would save 30 million euros. However, this cost-benefit analysis commissioned by these migrant rights groups showed that, on the contrary, the savings to be made by retaining the benefit would be in the order of 394 million euros. Purely, or primarily, because if the men, if the people who receive this aid return to their country of origin, they are no longer using various in-kind benefits such as healthcare. So it was calculated that this would save the Dutch welfare state almost 400 million euros. So that rather put the kibosh on the government's plans to withdraw this remigration legislation, and so the bill was withdrawn, the bill to repeal was withdrawn. And thereafter, the budgetary benefits of the remigration aid became much more explicitly important in EU discourse, and it's mainly thanks to these budgetary benefits that the aid continues to be in place. However, what threatens the legislation, or what threatened it rather, was the question of its legal conformity with the European Commission law on non-discrimination between different EU citizens. The European Commission doubted whether the bill in its new form was compatible with the principle of equal treatment, because it can only be received by certain EU citizens from the former recruitment countries such as Portugal, Italy, Spain, and so on. However, the European Commission's concerns were addressed in fairly minor revisions to the Act in 2011, 12, and this revised remigration benefit was passed in Parliament in 2013 and came into force in 2014. Turning to the French case, the aid for social, family and social reinsertion. As regards the initial motivations of policymakers in this area, I would characterise this as institutional repentance. The mid-2000s in France was a time when the contribution of, contribution to France of its former migrant workers and veteran soldiers and so on was reassessed. This is best symbolised by the film Andy Jen, which was a big box office hit in France. It follows the story of a group of North African troops who encounter a lot of bigotry and discrimination from their French comrades and armies during the Second World War, despite the fact that they bravely fought for a country which they had never seen. And this film is actually, as I mentioned, a huge box office hit and was quite instrumental in leading to a partial recognition of the pension rights of former French soldiers and former colonies. And this photo of one of the stars of the film with former Moroccan veterans kind of celebrating the news that the French government is kind of expanding their pension contributions gives you a insight there. However, more specifically, the migrant worker hostels themselves were a focus of this institutional repentance. 2006 report by the High Council for Integration was quite scathing on the situation of the residents of these migrant worker hostels. Generally, as you can perhaps imagine, the accommodation was not particularly high quality in the 1950s and 60s, and is not at all adapted for the needs of older people. So there's great difficulties going on there, and also the fact that the men are more or less obliged to be separated from their families in order to make ends meet through social protection measures and old age income support and so on, was denounced as a de facto inequality by the High Council for Integration. And furthermore, this report noted the high financial costs for France in hosting this aging population. So begin to see that there's also budgetary calculations behind some of these measures. It's not just institutional reasons. This led to drafting of the legislation by the Minister for Employment, Social Cohesion and Housing, Mr. Jean-Louis Borloo. So how did the legislation specifically developed? The bill passed through Parliament quite quickly. It was passed unanimously. There were various amendments about guarantees of reversibility of the benefit should somebody decide that this plan to return did not go so well. They could reintegrate into their former social lives in France and return. However, even though the legislation was passed in Parliament unanimously, there was then a change of government, and the incoming government, named the centre-right government of Sarkozy, was less favourable to this benefits aid. There were both political obstacles and a general climate of anti-immigration. The political obstacles are encapsulated by one of the policymakers who gave testimony to a parliamentary commission, and I quote, this individual: "Would the French population accept that people no longer living in our country can continue to receive benefits from the French welfare agency?" So this was this kind of question which he posed to his colleagues. And that kind of, I guess, encapsulates also that territorial logic of the welfare state. There were also legal obstacles, again, conformity with EU law, as I mentioned, also in the Dutch case. As a result of these political legal obstacles, the government decided to withhold the decrees of application, which is a French particularity, but most laws in France do not enter into force, even if they've been passed in Parliament, do not enter into force until the necessary decrees are drafted by the Conseil d'État, which is a state institution charged with assessing the legal soundness of laws. And the government withdrew these decrees in autumn 2008. So the Conseil d'État never had a chance to make a ruling. However, once again, change of government in 2012 to the centre-left Socialist Party. And Socialist Party is more favourable to this aid. There's been a parliamentary mission, and one of the key recommendations was to expedite the implementation of this law. This required some amendments to the text of the law in February 14, and according to insiders, the final implementation of this benefit should be imminent. So watch this space. hopefully be resolved by the time. So to conclude, what is interesting about both of these schemes is that the principles of territoriality and nationality are reversed. Consumption of social protection is to take place outside the state and is only available to non-nationals. And all of this at a time when European member state is, in all other respects, shrinking rather than expanding. In the Dutch case, these principles of territoriality and nationality were not controversial during its first 18 years until 2003. Later on, they did become an issue, but at that moment in time, the budgetary benefits of this aid became much more apparent, and that has meant that this aid is still on the statute books. In France, the aid was blocked due to issues with conformity with EU law and also political concerns about the scope of the welfare state, its territoriality. So, are these exceptions, the Dutch and French legislation, or is it the shape of things to come? Perhaps if the issue of conformity with European Commission law can be established, and precedent in EC law can be established, then we may see more of this, certainly as more and more people seek to age transnationally. There may be more pressure on governments to legislate in this way. And also, as I mentioned, the obvious budgetary benefits in the Dutch case, these counter-arguments of territoriality and nationality may well be appeased or appeasable if the budgetary case can be made clear. So I think these two measures in France and Netherlands perhaps point the way to how welfare states may develop their social protection measures, particularly for older people.